The Trump White House sat down with Russia and outlined a peace plan for Ukraine. Ukrainians are not happy.
This current framework would give Russia, if not military control, but certainly political control over Ukraine's future.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what's at stake for Ukraine in this proposed plan? Also, the transatlantic slave trade and its continuing impact on people in the Caribbean.
What we have found is that the legacies of slavery are there today in a very deadly manner.
Plus, cloud seeding in Indonesia, so the rain falls before it reaches cities vulnerable to flooding, and a Uyghur activist from China trying to rebuild websites taken down by the government.
Is it possible that Chinese authorities are monitoring what I've been doing? Sure.
That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for coming along. We begin today with a look at a new proposal to end the war in Ukraine. U.S. and Russian officials have been secretly drafting the plan. Kirill Dmitriev, an advisor to Russian President Vladimir Putin, says he and U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff wrote the 28-point framework during a face-to-face meeting last month in Miami. Ukrainians were not at the table.
The plan calls for major concessions from Ukraine, including handing over territory that it currently controls to Russia and drastically reducing the size of its armed forces. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told visiting U.S. military officials in Kyiv today that he is willing to work with Washington on the peace plan. All of this comes as Zelensky is embroiled in a widening corruption scandal. To learn more, we reached out to Alina Polyakova. She heads the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington.
The plan that's being discussed very much favors the Russian side. It represents Russia's maximalist demands. So, for example, it would prevent Ukraine from developing its military and, in fact, demand that Ukraine cut its military by half. It would not allow Ukraine to host any foreign troops on its soil, which would, of course, prevent Ukraine from joining NATO or any other military alliance, as well as not allow Ukraine to develop or source any long-range missile system capabilities, which have been very important in allowing Ukraine to hit Russian military targets inside of Russia. And the list goes on. So de facto, as is, this current framework would give Russia, if not military control, but certainly political control over Ukraine's future. And that's not something that is acceptable to the Ukrainian government or to the Ukrainian people.
Right. President Zelensky at this moment is facing a corruption scandal that involves members of his inner circle. So some are suggesting that Washington and Moscow are trying to force a bad deal on the Ukrainian president. At this moment, specifically, while he's politically weakened. What do you think?
Certainly, Zelensky is in a weakened position. That's absolutely right. And from Moscow's perspective, this is the right moment to resurface their list of demands and see if there may be more agreement to that in Ukraine. But I think this is honestly the wrong thinking by the Kremlin, which consistently misreads not just the Ukrainian government and Zelensky, but also the will of the Ukrainian people. Regardless of what is happening domestically in Ukraine, the public opinion is very, very clear. Ukrainians will not voluntarily give up their land. They will not voluntarily subjugate themselves to Russian control. So there's just very, very little, I think, that this plan can do to compel Ukrainians to comply, including Zelensky and including the broad population of the country.
But President Zelensky has told U.S. officials today that he is willing to work with Washington on the peace plan. Do you think that means anything?
I think that's the right decision. Ukrainians have done this over and over again. If you recall, there was the minerals deal that, of course, Ukraine and the United States signed. But initially, what was proposed was not something that Ukrainians liked very much because it didn't really favor their position. But they took that as a starting point for negotiations. They negotiated, I think, a very favorable deal to Ukraine in the end. And I think this is the right approach now. This is the starting point for negotiation, hopefully. Do I wish that the starting point didn't favor the Russian side so much? Yes. But I think the Ukrainians will take it and they'll put their ideas into it. And the United States, I think, as the broker, will take on the Ukrainian side as well.
Ukrainians continue to pay a high price for this war. Just last night, dozens of civilians, including children, died during Russian strikes on two nine-story buildings in the western city of Ternopil. What are Ukrainians on the ground likely to make of this U.S. brokered plan?
The great sadness here, to my mind, is that as this plan is being presented or leaked out there in the world, Russia has launched a new stage of escalation in its attacks on Ukrainian civilians in particular. Russia is increasingly targeting civilians outside the eastern and northern front lines. To my mind, this just goes back in the Ukrainian mindset to having more resolve to resist. And again, why Zelensky will have, despite the current dynamics on the corruption scandal, will have the people behind him in the end, because they will not give up their homes voluntarily.
But could Zelensky be eventually backed into a corner where his options are to accept a plan that he would rather not, or lose the support of his people?
No Ukrainian president would ever accept a plan like this that amounts to de facto Ukraine's capitulation to the Russians, because there would be a revolution on their hands. Ukrainians will not stand for it.
What should we be keeping an eye on in the coming days and weeks regarding how these negotiations go or don't?
We have been here before. In the spring, the Russian side was presented with a U.S.-led plan that did not look too dissimilar to the current framework that's being discussed. And unfortunately, what happened at the end of that is that the Russians said no to any concessions by them. And of course, for there to be a sustainable and lasting peace, which I very much commend the White House and the president, President Trump, for continuing to focus on this. It's really important. And I agree that we all want peace, and nobody wants peace more than the Ukrainian people. But at the end of the day, it's been the Russian side that's been an obstacle to peace. And last time we were in this position just a few months ago, it didn't end well. And it didn't end well because the Ukrainians agreed to a ceasefire and the Russian side did not. And unfortunately, I think that's once again what we're going to see here. And I think the administration, the United States, and Ukraine's European allies will have to pivot towards a very different policy if we want a peaceful and sustainable agreement.
Whether the president in Ukraine, though, accepts a plan like this or not, could it be forced upon Ukraine if it is where the U.S. insists on things landing?
I think Europe will stand behind Ukraine no matter what, because Ukraine is Europe. And I think Europeans have stepped up their military and economic support to Ukraine, which is now larger than what the U.S. supplies. So at this point, the United States is still doing quite a bit in support of Ukraine. Of course, intelligence sharing, there's still some security assistance that's going out. There's, of course, the sale of U.S. arms and equipment to NATO allies that are then providing that U.S. equipment to Ukraine. So we're still doing quite a bit in the United States to support Ukraine. And there's certainly a scenario in which all of that support gets cut off. But I just don't think that's really where we're heading. Ukraine has allies across the world, certainly in Europe, and many other allies in the Indo-Pacific that don't want to see Ukraine subjugated to Russia, because, of course, what's happening in Ukraine is really not an isolated conflict. How it ends will have long-term consequences for the United States and for U.S. global standing in the world.
Alina Polyakova is the president of the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington.
Fifty years ago today, the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco died. November 20th is also the day that Spain began its transition to democracy. A key player in that story is the former king, Juan Carlos I, but he won't be in Spain to observe this moment. He's in exile in Dubai. The king has some things to atone for, and he's hoping a memoir he's just published will help. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Juan Carlos's autobiography is entitled Reconciliation. The 87-year-old exiled royal wants to make up with his family and Spaniards in general. He also wants to come home. The young King Juan Carlos started out as a national hero. He'd been groomed in his youth by dictator Franco, presumably to be his strongman heir. But after Franco's death in 1975, the king bet the house on democracy. That transition took 3 years.
Con esa ilusión queda abierta la legislatura.
With great hopes, this legislative session is now open, Juan Carlos told newly elected members of Spain's Congress in December 1977. In a recent Spanish TV documentary, an elderly Juan Carlos recounted how he sat with Franco on his deathbed.
Me cogió la mano y me dijo, Alteza, lo único que le pido es que mantenga la unidad de España.
Franco told me, whatever you do, you must maintain the unity of the nation. But he didn't say how, Juan Carlos says. In 1981, Juan Carlos cemented his place in modern Spanish history by thwarting a military uprising.
La corona, símbolo de la permanencia y unidad de la patria.
As leaders of a coup held Congress hostage, Juan Carlos jumped on the boob tube to condemn the assault. The crown, he said in a live broadcast, will not tolerate any attempts to interrupt by force what the Spanish people voted for. Up to that point, there was little to merit a memoir called Reconciliation. What came next, though? Different story. Illicit love affairs, dodgy personal enrichment, including a so-called gift of $100 million from a Saudi prince, and a secret offshore bank account. Juan Carlos's most embarrassing scandal happened in 2012. While Spaniards were struggling through a major economic crisis, the king slipped away in secret to shoot elephants in Botswana with his mistress. The public only found out because the monarch fell, breaking his hip. He had to be evac'd home, all on the taxpayer's dime.
Lo siento mucho. Me he equivocado y no volverá a ocurrir.
I'm sorry, a frail-looking Juan Carlos told reporters, leaving the hospital with the help of a cane. I won't ever do that again. Soon after, under pressure, Juan Carlos abdicated. In 2020, after the funny money stories broke, the king's son, now Felipe VI, renounced his father's inheritance. Juan Carlos went into exile in Dubai. There, he's lived a lavish, if lonely, life. Not even his wife, the queen, has come to visit. So far, the royal family hasn't commented on the memoir, which comes out in December, but advance copies are circulating, and early reaction isn't great. A couple of doozies. Juan Carlos criticizes his son's wife, the hugely popular Queen Leticia, as divisive, and he complains that he must be the only retired Spaniard who's not getting a pension. Most controversially, Juan Carlos writes with fondness of the late dictator Franco. It's a sentiment many Spaniards do not share.
Yo creo que lo más escandaloso dice que lo respetaba enormemente a Franco, que apreciaba su inteligencia y su sentido político.
On Spanish radio this week, journalist José Luis Sastre called Juan Carlos's praise for Franco scandalous, especially, he said, where the former king lauds the general for his intelligence and boasts that no one in four decades managed to take him down. The former king forgets to mention, Sastre said, just how Franco kept his enemies at bay. Franco's preferred methods were long prison sentences or firing squads. The pushback against reconciliation can't come as a total surprise to the aging monarch. Juan Carlos writes early in the book that his father once warned him not to put pen to paper. Royals, he cautioned, have more to lose than gain by telling their stories. This Saturday is the 50th anniversary of Juan Carlos I's coronation. It marked the dawn of a modern, prosperous Spain. The country, including the royal family, will celebrate the event without the former king himself. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
Speaking of books that may very well backfire, another controversial figure in Spain has just published a memoir. Luis Rubiales is the former head of the Spanish Soccer Federation. He was fired last year, as you may recall, for forcibly kissing soccer star Jenny Hermoso during a World Cup victory celebration.
Rubiales maintains to this day that the kiss was consensual. Here he is speaking last week in Madrid for the launch of his new book, which is called Killing Rubiales.
They want me to apologize, Rubiales told the small crowd, but I will never apologize to a liar.
A liar is not how Spanish judges see Jenny Hermoso. Earlier this year, they convicted Rubiales of sexual aggression for that kiss. Rubiales' appeal was rejected. Now he is taking his side of the story directly to the public with a book.
Luego hay también en determinadas instituciones y en determinados
medios. People are churning out disinformation and lies about me, Rubiales said at the book talk.
But while he was hoping to gain control of the narrative, somebody else unexpectedly stole the show during the event. His uncle, Luis. This was when the uncle stood up and pelted his nephew with three eggs. He was apparently angry about the rift that notorious kiss has caused in the family. Security guards intervened to keep a furious Rubiales and his uncle apart. The book presentation eventually resumed.
In terms of press covers, though, it was eggs one, autobiography nil.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Officials from more than a dozen Caribbean nations are in the United Kingdom this week. They're on a campaign for reparations from the UK for its role in the transatlantic slave trade and the mistreatment of people in former British colonies. The UK government has long rejected calls for reparations, so delegates are focused on appealing directly to the British public. Eric Phillips is one of those delegates from Guyana.
We're part of a global reparations movement that involves the African Union, CARICOM, Latin America. We're all forming a common umbrella to seek redress for 400 years of slavery and indigenous genocide.
The group CARICOM, he mentioned, is a multilateral group of Caribbean nations. It's the organizer of the conference. Eric Phillips spoke with me this week from London.
I think most people don't realize that over a period of 270 years, 12 British monarchs sponsored, supported, and profited from Britain's involvement in slavery. So in the Caribbean, we've had about 20 countries that were enslaved. The people were enslaved. The British were integrally involved. As a matter of fact, the British brought over 3 million people to the Caribbean, and at emancipation, which was in 1834, only 800,000 survived. So the role of Britain in the Caribbean has been extensive. And as you know, slavery and indigenous genocide are both crimes against humanity. Now, what we have found is that the legacies of slavery are there today in a very deadly manner. For example, Barbados is known as the amputation capital of the world.
Barbados, the amputation capital, you said?
Yes, of the world. And that's because we have diabetes. About 70% of all the people in the Caribbean are predisposed to diabetes. And we have some of the most chronic diseases in the Caribbean. As you know, we grew sugar, and they said you eat what you grow. So many of us and our ancestors grew up eating sugar. And of course, the crimes are horrendous. If you were to look at the Rome Statute, you'll see that indeed slavery was a crime against humanity. We try to look at slavery from a different perspective. We're trying to change the narrative. We say that slavery was the world's first nuclear bomb. And that led to the second world's nuclear bomb, which is racism, because we're living the legacies of racism today in many different ways. Our countries have been underdeveloped because of slavery.
Yeah, I mean, you're essentially saying the history of enslavement of Africans has a long legacy, including into the 20th century and on post-colonial relations.
Yes. And indeed, if you just look at Hurricane Melissa in Jamaica, the part of Jamaica that was levied by the hurricane, you could have thought of it as Plantation Jamaica, because that's where the plantations were. People were living today in poverty, generational poverty. The homes are wooden, and Hurricane Melissa wiped it away.
So what would reparations look like? Because the commission you're part of is calling on the UK to pay reparations for its role in the slave trade.
Yes, we have a 10-point plan, which is a development plan. Our approach is to find a partnership with Britain, a win-win situation based on our 10-point plan. That plan consists of the following: a formal apology. Britain has refused to apologize. They've said they regret it. But this is a crime against humanity, and we need an apology. We're looking for repatriation and resettlement for those who want to go back to Africa. We're also looking for indigenous people's development, because 15 million indigenous people were decimated in the Caribbean. We're looking at restitution of cultural heritage and cultural reconnection. We're looking at public health crisis. We're looking at illiteracy eradication. We're looking at compensation for violence against women and the family. We're looking at psychological rehabilitation. We're looking at technology transfer and the right to development. And of course, we're looking at debt cancellation and monetary compensation.
You described a mix, Eric, of financial and non-financial reparations. How much can you imagine the sum total of reparations being?
Well, there have been many studies, many valuations. Some start as much as $17 trillion for the UK. But overall, the Brattle report, which is the most recent report, stated that 31 countries owe between $100 and $131 trillion for loss of life, loss of liberty, loss of labor, psychological harm, sexual harm. So these are accountants who, for example, are used when a plane crashes, where they look at the total harm and they've put a valuation to it. But we are not focused on that. That's one of our 10 points.
Well, I'm curious, Eric, whether you've had officials from the UK government in any of your meetings this week.
No, this is a meeting to discuss approach with the British public through many different ways, to meet with our ambassadors, because they have to advocate, you know, for us. We have 21 African ambassadors in the Commonwealth in England. We have 13 Caribbean ambassadors. They're the ones that need to find mechanisms along with us to educate the British public.
Well, it was reported several days ago that you would meet with parliamentarians. Is anyone from the British government willing to speak with you from Parliament?
Well, we have met individually over the last several months with the All-Party Parliamentary Group. This is a group of Afro-Britons who are in different parties of the United Kingdom but are in Parliament. We've been interfacing with them.
Eric, when you get back to Guyana, to the Caribbean, what progress will you be able to report on the pursuit of reparations after the visit this week to the UK?
Well, our goal was to educate, and I think we've accomplished that. We're here to raise awareness. We're here to share information. We're here to make sure that there's clarity in what we plan to do. We are here to make sure that the 10-point plan is not misunderstood. We're here to make sure that people don't think we're just after money. Listen, Britain has been extracting wealth from the Caribbean for centuries. We didn't come here to extract wealth from Britain. We're here to negotiate in partnership so that we can develop the Caribbean. I mean, you gave us war and slavery, and now we give you freedom because you're free to come to the Caribbean and enjoy it.
Eric Phillips is a member of the CARICOM Reparations Commission. He spoke with us from London. And now a few global headlines from the Diplomacy Desk.
South Africa hosts the Group of 20 summit starting this weekend. As of today, a U.S. representative will be in attendance. President Trump had said the U.S. would boycott the G20, citing his widely rejected claims that white South Africans are facing persecution. Today, the White House said an official from the U.S. Embassy in South Africa will attend a formal ceremony at the end of the summit, but will not take part in any talks.
Moving on to COP, the annual UN climate summit, Turkey and Australia were both vying to host next year's conference, and it appears they've reached a compromise. COP31 will be held in Turkey, but Australia will handle the agenda. That is a disappointment to island nations in the Pacific. They had hoped that holding COP31 in Australia would focus attention on their dire future with sea level rise.
Meanwhile, there was a scare at the current climate summit being held in Belém, Brazil. A fire spread through the pavilions on the sidelines of the conference. No one was hurt, but many were evacuated as smoke filled the area. An official said the fire started near the China Pavilion and quickly spread to many of the Africa pavilions nearby. The venue for COP30 was under construction right up until the conference opened last week.
Find more global news at theworld.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. One piece of news coming out of this week's visit by the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, to the White House. President Trump announced that the U.S. would be selling advanced military jets to Saudi Arabia. This is a sensitive sale, one that has the kingdom's neighbors in the region worried. The World's Shireen Jafari is here with more details. So let's start with some of the basics, Shireen. What is it about these jets that makes them so desirable?
The F-35s have some of the most advanced technology among the fighter jets in the world. They're called the fifth generation stealth fighters, which basically, Marco, means that they can fly into enemy airspace without being detected. They're sometimes described as the quarterback of the skies, using the American football metaphor, because they can collect intelligence that they then can share with the ground units, ships, and other aircrafts.
Yeah, so pretty sophisticated stuff.
Yes. Here's how retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery described it to me. He's with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He served in the U.S. Navy for 32 years.
It is the best fifth-generation aircraft out there, and it's certainly the backbone of democratic air forces in Europe and in Asia.
So there's some precedent for their usefulness.
So is he saying that the air forces in Europe and Asia have them? Like, who else has them?
Yes, the U.S. has sold these aircrafts to other countries. Israel is one of them. Others include mainly NATO allies like Denmark, Canada, Germany, Italy, and the U.K. About 19 countries have ordered them. And there's actually, Marco, a backlog of these jets at Lockheed Martin, which is the company that makes them.
Right. What is the price tag on the F-35s?
Quite a bit of money, somewhere between $60 and $100 million each, depending on the capabilities and how many the country orders.
So you spoke a bit about their technological capabilities. How are these actually used? Give us an example.
Yeah, so recently the F-35s were used in the war against Iran during the summer. You might recall that war. Stacey Pettijohn is a defense expert with the Center for a New American Security, which is a think tank in Washington. She explained to me the role that the F-35s played in that war.
The F-35s were the escorts that protected the B-2 stealth bombers, which carried the very big penetrating bombs that destroyed the heavily buried nuclear sites. And the F-35s carried weapons that could attack Iranian air defenses and if there were any fighter jets that came out to meet them.
So again, you know, these aircrafts were able to enter Iranian airspace without being detected. And that's what makes them so unique.
So Shirin, going back to the F-35 deal with the Saudis, let's focus on the Middle East. Israel, as you said, already has these jets. The Saudis will now have them. Will that change the dynamics in the region?
It's way too early to tell, Marco. Saudi Arabia has been in talks with the U.S. about a broad security deal. It wants guarantees from the U.S. that it will come to its defense if it's attacked. And then, you know, the Saudis worry about tensions in the region in general. There's been previous attacks from Iran and the Israeli attacks in Gaza and on Qatar, another Gulf country. Saudi Arabia wants to beef up its defenses. Now, there's a law that requires the U.S. to make sure that Israel always has a military advantage in the region, meaning that the U.S. cannot sell any weapons to Middle Eastern countries that undermine Israel's security. And Mark Montgomery, the Rear Admiral that we heard from earlier, explained another requirement that the U.S. has when it comes to weapon sales.
If you're going to be a recipient of the highest end U.S. technology, that you take actions to protect that technology. And sometimes that means you can't operate with certain countries around the world, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. The real player in that, of course, is China.
So has Saudi Arabia given any assurances about that?
Montgomery told me that normally these negotiations take place behind closed doors. Saudi Arabia has been conducting military drills with China recently, and a Pentagon report raised some concerns about these drills. But at the same time, the delivery of these jets can take a while.
All foreign military sales are fairly slow. They're measured in years, not months or days.
So it could be a while before Saudi Arabia gets its hands on these fighter jets. Mm. And remember, Marco, these sales can even fall through. For example, the United Arab Emirates was supposed to get 50 of these jets after it agreed to sign on to the Abraham Accords in 2020. But 5 years later, the UAE still doesn't have these jets. And in fact, the deal seems to have stalled altogether.
The World, Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
China's western region of Xinjiang is the historic home of the Uyghurs. They're a Muslim minority who the Chinese government sees as a security threat. China's heavy-handed security policies in Xinjiang, according to the United Nations, may constitute crimes against humanity. The Chinese government dismisses that sort of criticism and denies claims from human rights groups that it is trying to erase the Uyghur language, culture, and history. Today, we'll hear about an effort to preserve that legacy. Sean Powers of the Click Here podcast reports on one man who is determined to resurrect material that's been removed from the internet.
In a small apartment in Tokyo, Raidat Kenji sits in front of his computer, scrolling through a digital world that no longer exists. Fragments of news, bits of poetry, dead links. Click by click, line by line, Rideout is resurrecting something that the Chinese government has been working very hard to erase.
I've managed to restore hundreds of pages in my spare time.
This is Rideout. He doesn't speak English. His answers came to us in Uyghur, and we had them translated and voiced so that you could hear his story. He's using the Internet Archive. It's this kind of time machine for the web that takes snapshots of websites so that they don't disappear. Rideout is trying to recreate something that once was a thriving Uyghur internet.
Currently, there are 3,000 to 5,000 websites on archive.org. I'm compiling a list of these websites and documenting how much content from each site has been archived. Uyghur websites are a treasure trove of knowledge, and I'm trying to save it. I want to save all of this.
We like to think that the internet is forever, but memory is fragile, even in the cloud. Pages fade, links rot, and cultures can be erased pixel by pixel unless someone rushes in to save it. It all started with this protest, followed by an eerie silence. In July 2009, protests broke out in Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang province in the far northwestern part of China. Violence followed. More than 100 Han Chinese residents were killed, and the Chinese government responded by flipping a switch, an internet switch.
That was a major shutdown.
This is Johar Ilham. She's a Uyghur activist now living in the United States.
Even when people had footages of proofs and like they had live footages of, you know, what was going on, they weren't allowed to, you know, release it. They weren't allowed to talk to journalists and stuff. It was a very dark time.
10 months without internet in Xinjiang. 10 months when Uyghur news sites went dark and social media platforms blinked out one by one. And when the government finally flipped the switch back on, the Uyghur internet, that fragile, thriving world of language, music, and debate had been hollowed out. Websites that once served as cultural lifelines were gone. Forums were shuttered and entire archives erased. And among them was Uyghur Online, the site her father, Ilham Toti, built. He was a scholar and a quiet revolutionary at that. And his platform gave Uyghurs a space to speak freely about their culture, their language, their future. This was when even quiet dissent was dangerous. And it was around the time when Chinese authorities began rounding up Uyghurs and putting them into re-education camps.
Everybody reaching out to him said, my son disappeared, my cousin disappeared, or this disappeared. The Chinese government took them. We don't know if he's alive, if he's been in prison, if he has been shot with a machine gun. We don't know what happened. And then so my father started compiling all of these people's identities and pictures.
By 2016, nearly all the websites in the Uyghur language that were hosted in China and once a backbone of communication in Xinjiang had vanished. Rideout Kenji was living in Japan and working as a software engineer. When he saw Chinese authorities systematically dismantle the Uyghur web, he had this sick feeling in the pit of his stomach.
I was crushed. Under the pretext of regulating all Uyghur websites, some website owners were arrested.
Before moving to Japan, Rideout was a teacher in Xinjiang.
I was living a normal life with my family in Xinjiang. When I'd come home to visit, there was always trouble. Like I went back to my hometown in 1999 after living in Japan for a while, and people from the State Security Administration came to my house and started questioning me.
China's State Security Administration is the country's main intelligence agency. It had Rideout in its sights.
They took me to a government hotel and in one of the rooms, and they asked me about what Japanese television broadcasts about China and whether I had contact with my friend Dolkun Issa.
Dolkun Issa. For Beijing, that name is radioactive. He's the former president of the World Uyghur Congress, an advocacy group that China has branded as a separatist and dangerous organization. For Rideout, though, Dolkun wasn't a political figure. He was a friend, someone he'd known for years. But that friendship made him a target. And when he went home again in 2003, the pattern repeated. The same questions, the same threats.
After that, I never went back to my hometown.
He hasn't been back to Xinjiang in more than 20 years, but it's never far from his mind. Every headline, every whispered story of fresh crackdowns are a reminder of the place he's left behind. So he started looking for ways to help from afar. And because he knows how to code, he realized that there might be a way. If the government could erase Uyghur websites, maybe, just maybe, he could bring them back. He began preserving what Chinese authorities had tried to erase.
If I had sufficient financial resources, I would dedicate my entire time to restoring these websites.
But he has to work. So in his spare time, he built something he calls UyghurArchive.com. Think of it as a digital time capsule.
I went into the Internet Archive and started looking for original Uyghur websites that have been taken down. These are ones that you can't find even if you just do a Google search.
One of the first sites he focused on was Bagdash. It was kind of a Facebook for Uyghurs, a digital gathering place where people could share music, tell stories, and feel a sense of belonging.
The most difficult thing about restoring websites like Bagdash is the incredibly difficult nature of restoring all the content that is on the Internet Archive.
There have been a lot of little technical problems, like parts of pages missing or the inability to recover uploaded music.
And I've managed to do a lot of it, like recovering the original web pages so they look like they did when they were on the web. Things like restoring music and audio and images to their original state. It's been hard.
He's been restoring what he can. Music, audio, images, bringing them back to their original state. It's painstaking work. Some essays and songs survived. But all the videos that were uploaded, gone.
I've retrieved anything I can from the Internet Archive, but whatever wasn't saved, it's not possible for me to bring it back.
And even for the sites that do survive, the ones hosted outside of China, there's no guarantee they're safe. They're constant targets for hacks and takedowns. And inside China, well, things have gone from bad to worse. Speaking out online has become even harder, so people have to get creative. China's internet is vast. Millions of websites, more than a billion users. But within that system, Uyghur voices occupy only a sliver of space. And even that space is tightly policed. Here again is Johar Ilham.
So even though the social media is very much censored, Uyghur people have been trying to find very unique and creative ways to get messages out. For example, they would sing a song that has like hidden meaning that only Uyghur people will understand.
Like this song that a Uyghur worker in Qingdao posted. One day I will come back, they sing. Please don't lose hope. People post images too, like family photos, which seem almost mundane until you look a little closer.
You actually see hundreds of exact same formatted videos of different people, basically with family photos in the back and then raise their fingers. That's like how many people have been arrested in her family. So they would like, oh, that's like six people in her family.
Other messages are even more subtle. For example, when someone says their cousin went to school, that might mean they were taken to a re-education camp. Or when someone is in the hospital for 20 years, it's not about healthcare.
So you're not allowed to say camps. You say school. You say somebody went to school and it's not really going to school. They went to camps. Or it's like, oh, somebody went to studies for 10 years. That means like somebody were sentenced to 10 years. Or someone is working, got a new job, and they're going to love this factory job. And that's like forced labor.
It's a code, an encryption of daily life. We reported last year on a group of young Uyghur activists in Germany who began posting TikToks. Their videos are meant to draw attention to human rights abuses in Xinjiang. But the clips kept getting flagged and taken down by TikTok's parent company, ByteDance. It's based in Beijing. So the group adapted, again mirroring viral trends to sneak in their messages.
We are Uyghurs. Of course we're always late.
We are Uyghurs. Of course we don't have basic human rights.
We are Uyghurs. Of course China is selling our organs.
We are Uyghurs.
Authoritarian regimes have long feared the internet, so they delete. they censor, they monitor, they punish. But what Raidat Kenji is doing, quietly, persistently, is the opposite of that. He's building a kind of archive of resistance, a living map of what was, and maybe, just maybe, what still could be.
I haven't felt any danger doing this. I'm going to keep going. Is it possible that Chinese authorities are monitoring what I've been doing? Sure. But I'm more worried about what I might not be able to do. That there will be thousands of Uyghur websites on the Internet Archive that I won't be able to bring back and restore.
So far, he's brought back more than 300 websites to the Uyghur Archive. Homepages once thought lost. Essays. Music. Cultural memory. Each one a small defiance. Each one a digital heartbeat, where there was once silence. For the World, I'm Sean Powers.
Sean produces the Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News. This story is the final chapter in a four-part series we've aired about people trying to protect and preserve Uyghur culture and the persecution they face from Chinese authorities. Hear the other stories and learn more at theworld.org. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The main Indonesian island of Java has been getting pummeled by rain. Landslides there have killed at least 23 people in several villages prone to flooding over the past week. Seasonal downpours and landslides are common in Indonesia, but climate change is making them worse. Officials have been betting on a technology that they believe can protect the country from superstorms. Reporter Patrick Nguyen went to Jakarta, Indonesia's capital, to see how it works.
The cockpit is shuddering. The clouds ahead look ominous, but pilot Harun Rifai is headed straight at them.
Normal configuration, set power.
At 29, Rifai is a young pilot. His co-pilot, Najwa Inaya, is just 23. But they have flown more weather modification missions than they can count. Many by day and many in the middle of the night. Najwa tells me, the cockpit shuddering and shaking, you get used to it.
In a way, some turbulence is nice to keep us awake.
Yeah.
You know, it jolts you awake. You really have to focus then.
Now, this cockpit we're in, it's actually a very realistic, life-sized simulator that shakes and tilts. It mimics a Cessna Caravan, a propeller plane about the size of a school bus. Today is a training day. We'd planned to go up in a real plane, but it's sunny out, and you can't summon rain from clear skies. So says Budi Harsoyo, a meteorologist, formerly with Indonesia's top weather agency. He now works here at the headquarters of First Aviation, a company hired by the government to change the weather.
Prinsipnya modifikasi cuaca itu bukan membuat hujan.
You can't make rain from thin air, Budi says, but you can make a cloud on the brink of rain go ahead and start raining. To do that, you fly a plane towards the cloud and release a special powder.
It's basically salt, but it's very, very fine.
Hansen Majaya heads up business development at First Aviation. He's handing me a glass jar full of silky white powder.
This doesn't look like table salt.
Yes, it is way finer than table salt, and you can't find this anywhere. It's a special kind of salt.
They pack this salt into cylindrical flares attached to struts on the plane. Then, when pilots veer towards a big gray cloud, weather scientists in the back of the plane will press buttons at just the right time and pop, pop. The flares fire salt crystals into the cloud. Salt pulls more moisture out of the air into the cloud until it's so heavy with droplets that the rain pours out. Hansen says it works consistently.
People, more and more people, is realizing how effective weather modification is.
Indonesian officials are true believers. This is a big country, longer end-to-end than the continental United States. As of last year, the government has run weather modification missions most days of the year. Most missions are contracted out, and this company, First Aviation, is the top contractor. Say a nasty storm is coming for Jakarta, the capital. If it pours on 30 million residents, the streets will flood. First Aviation will fly out and try to trigger clouds to dump much of their rain over the ocean before it reaches the city.
The government keeps coming back to us because they have seen results. So I think we can conclude that it's efficient and it's successful.
Government officials claim these missions can reduce a storm's rain output over targeted areas by more than half. Others are skeptical.
The one thing that is clear, it's very hard to make any cloud rain.
Professor Martin Ambaum is an expert on atmospheric physics at the University of Reading in the UK. He says every cloud is incredibly complex and unique. So it's hard to prove that the cloud you just infused with salt wasn't about to rain anyway.
The simplest way to think about it is no control experiment, right? As you might have in a medical trial where you keep and give people placebos or an experimental drug, and you can see whether the experimental drug works better than the placebo.
In recent years, Professor Ambaum has noticed more interest in weather modification around the world. China does it, U.S. states do it, so does Russia, India, and Thailand. For governments, it is tempting to try and manipulate the skies, especially in the era of climate change. But Ambaum isn't sure it's working as well as humanity wants it to.
There's scientists working on it for decades, and it's certainly not a solved problem at all.
Still, the weather modification business is going strong. First Aviation is busier than ever. Their competition is actually rain shamans, mystics who chant and light incense to ward off storms. Indonesian officials hire them too, and so do couples planning expensive weddings outdoors. But one recently turned to Hansen to keep their wedding dry.
Yeah, it's an outdoor event, so they didn't want it to rain, so they hired us to do some weather modification.
On that special day, he says, the skies were lovely, just like he promised. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Jakarta, Indonesia.
Finally today, if you think art is priceless, you have not been to an auction at Sotheby's. Yesterday, the bidding for a famous painting from Austria made history.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we come to an unequivocal masterpiece of Vienna's golden age.
Gustav Klimt's portrait of Elisabeth Lederer sold for more than any other work of modern art at auction.
In a video from Sotheby's, you can see the auctioneer in a crisp tuxedo addressing the room. The painting hangs up behind him.
This is one of the finest and most intricately conceived of Klimt's celebrated full-length portraits.
So, a quick description of the work. There's a woman dressed in white standing against a smoky blue background. She's on this orange rug, so you see her, but you also see blocks of color. Blue on top, orange below. Very modern, very Klimt. The bidding was intense.
And I'm going to start the bidding at $130 million. At $130 million for the Klimt. At $130 million now. $130 million. At $130 million. $132 million. At $132 million. At $132 million. $134 million now.
And the bidding escalated quickly.
$205 million. Thank you. At $205 million.
That's when the last couple of hopefuls still on their phones pointedly hung up.
That's the sure sign. Anybody else want to come in? Thank you very much indeed. It's at $205 million. And the hammer is coming up, ladies and gentlemen. I think this is it. At $205 million. Here it is.
Including fees, the total price came to $236.4 million. Another record is expected to be broken tonight when Frida Kahlo's El Sueño, La Cama goes up for auction. It is expected to fetch the top price for a female artist's work at auction.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.